Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 13, Structured Products, CLOs, REMICs, REPACs, and Whole Loans. Reid Auerbach, John Arnolds, and Jim Gower will discuss risk retention strategies and tax considerations regarding structured products. Now, on to the podcast.
My name is Reid Auerbach, and I am co-chair of the Structured Transaction Group here at Morgan Lewis, along with my partner, also my co-chair, John Arnolds, to my right, and to my left is Jim Gower, tax expert in various structured and securitization matters. We are from Legacy Bingham McCutcheon. We combined with Morgan Lewis in November. We tried to come up with two topics that we thought were hot on at least our clients' minds in the hedge fund space, which is risk retention and structured tax issues that fund managers are facing in various aspects of their business. John, why don't we start with you? Generally, maybe you could tell us what the risk retention rules require and why they are so important.
Happy to. Risk retention is going to change structured transactions. This was the outgrowth of the securitization crisis of 2008 and that period. And these rules are the congressional response to how to deal with what went wrong back then. And they require that everybody who does a deal, every securitizer, and we'll come back and talk about that later, but every securitizer that initiates a transaction has to hold 5% of the deal. The theory, of course, is obvious that if you have a financial stake in what you're securitizing, the transaction is going to be of a higher quality. That's the theory. We'll see what happens. But you got to worry about it because it's a very broad definition of what securitization is. So pretty much any transaction that looks remotely like a securitization is going to get pulled into these new rules. Now, there are a handful of exceptions. If you're securitizing very high quality stuff, for example, mortgage loans, qualified mortgage loans, there, if your pool consists entirely of those assets, you don't have to retain the 5%. High quality autos, certain type of CLOs, other assets are exempt from the risk retention rules. They're largely uneconomic, except for the mortgage one, and it would be unusual that you could find enough qualified auto loans, for example, to securitize and fall within the rule. Now, the rule is flexible on how you comply. Reid, you want to talk a little bit about the form of the...
I think, John, you touched on this, but it's important to note that this applies to both public and private securitizations.
Rated and unrated.
And rated and unrated. So it does pick up all of our deals, basically. There are three forms of permitted risk retention. One is called a vertical risk retention, and that's basically going down the credit structure. So if you have an A, a AAA, AA, single A, down to BBB, you'd take 5% of each of those tranches. And the agencies have also allowed to come up with one class that would simulate, in essence, that vertical tranche. And you have to hold a 5% vertical piece. Another way to satisfy these requirements is through the eligible horizontal risk retention. And that is, in essence, the most junior ABS interest in your deal. It has to be in the first loss position and take losses on P&I. And again, you need 5%. One of the challenging aspects on the horizontal side is that there's a definitional issue where it's 5% based on the fair value of the interest offered, and while the vertical slice is just based on 5% of the face amount of the securities, the ABS interests that are issued. So it'll be interesting to see how people address that. And then lastly, you can do a combination of both vertical and horizontal risk retention. One of the things that the agencies refused to do was to permit the random sample. And that was pretty popular on European issuances where you would basically say you picked a random sample of your assets and securitized that and retained the sufficient assets on your balance sheet of a similar quality in order to satisfy risk retention, and that the agencies have rejected. John, one of the big issues and really relevant for our friends in the audience here is who has to hold that risk retention and how does that work?
Yeah, it's a good point. And this is where it gets very interesting. On the one hand, the rules guys, the people who wrote the rules, said, we're going to bring in all securitizations. But then they said, we'll give you a little bit of flexibility. Who has to hold on to that 5% piece is where a lot of the action is. Now, generally, it has to be the securitizer. Who's that? Well, that's the guy who kind of thought up the deal. Technically, it's the entity that initiated the transaction by selecting the assets and putting them in the transaction. Makes sense. If you want the person to be exposed to the performance of the deal, you find the guy who selects the assets. Makes sense. It's the person who has most skin in the game. But the rules do also provide that in certain cases, with certain asset classes, you can let an originator, in other words, the originator of the loan or asset itself, they can hold part or all of the 5% piece. Special rules were permitted for commercial mortgage-backed securities, and there the B piece holder is allowed to hold the retention. And there's a variety of rules about that govern how in a CMBS deal you hold that retention. The interesting thing in CLOs, it's the manager that has to hold the asset. This is unusual because the manager never usually owns an asset. Most securitizers actually buy the asset and convey it somehow into the deal to get the deal rolling. But for a CLO offering, you need to have the manager retained. Talking about CLOs, there's a special treatment for what are called open market CLOs. And there you have the lead loan arranger can hold 5% of the underlying loan that goes in the deal. But all the action, and this is an interesting thing, all the action really surrounds this idea that it's a securitizer or a majority-owned affiliate. Now, what does that mean? A majority-owned affiliate is someone who is owned 51% by the securitizer. And you can see right off what that means. If you can own 51%, that means you can sell 49% off. And that would reduce your exposure to the retention. And it gets even more dramatic. The rule also says the majority subsidiary is one that where the controlling financial interest is retained by the securitizer according to GAAP. And based on GAAP treatment, that can be as low as 20% of the affiliate. Very controversial area. Reed and I have talked about it with our partners as to whether or not the rule writers really meant you could utilize a majority subsidiary to sell off as much as maybe 80% of the retention. I'm not entirely sure, but notice that how you hold the retention is going to bear a great deal on your strategy, your most efficient strategy in complying. A couple other quick things. Reed, what about financing or hedging? What are the restrictions on what you can do with the piece once you hold on to it?
Yeah, I think first, John, who's ever retaining the risk has to hold it for a specified period under the rules. And for asset-backed securities, it's basically the latest of when the loans in the pool pay down to 33% of its unpaid principal balance, or the actual bonds get paid down to 33% of their original principal amount, or 2 years after the date of issuance. In RMBS, it's the later of 5 years, or when 25% of the unpaid principal balance of the loans is remaining, but no later than 7 years. As far as hedging, basically there's very limited hedging, and the hedges are only allowed for interest rate risk and currency risk, basically. You can use an index to hedge, but the assets that are in being securitized can't represent any more than 10% of that index. So they really want the risk retained to have the skin in the game that John spoke about earlier. And then on the financing side, the key is there's no financing allowed of these interests except on a recourse basis to the borrower. And one of the strategies that we've been toying with, along with this majority-owned subsidiary idea, is whether or not you can create a subsidiary, own the retention in a particular deal, finance it on a recourse basis, but the only asset in that sub is, in essence, the equity in the CLO, for example. There's nothing strictly prohibiting that in the rules, and it's something that is getting a lot of play. So if you think about what John said, you could sell off a good chunk of the risk in that majority-owned sub to a third-party investor, then finance it on a recourse basis to an SPV, which is just secured by that asset, and it doesn't have any other assets, and in essence, drastically reduce your risk retention.
Let me just, I know we want to turn to tax read, but let me just jump quick to when these rules are effective. It's kind of a Christmas present. For RMBS, they're effective December 24th, 2015. If you're a non-mortgage deal, you get an extra year, auto, student loans, et cetera. They're not effective. The rules are not effective for those assets until December 24th, 2016. A couple of very quick things about the effective date. Repackagings of securities, which is very popular among a lot of folks I see in the audience, there's a question as to whether or not a repack or resecuritization of a mortgage bond should be subject to the rules now or in another year. We generally think it should be 2 years. It's a separate asset class, but we're happy to talk to anyone about that. Another strategy we see moving around the effective date are these sort of, I don't know if you've heard of them, but these delayed draw bonds and the CLOs, where you don't draw down, you issue them now before the effective date, and then you draw down after the effective date. So strategies that we're seeing. Let's turn to tax. Reid had mentioned that we'd look at that along with retention. And Jim, one of the things that we're seeing a lot on our end are funds with foreign investors going out and buying older assets. A lot of challenges in getting those deals done.
Well, John, what you're really talking about is buying sort of a residual interest in an old deal, buying a residual interest in an old auto deal, buying a residual interest in an old student loan deal, buying something like that, rather than buying any bonds that were previously issued.
Correct.
Bonds, they were set up to go to foreigners. But a lot of these older deals, you have always two issues on tax you're always trying to think of, and you have to try to figure out which one is winding your tax lawyer up at any point in time. If you have foreign investors don't want to pay the gross income tax, usually referred to as the withholding tax, because it's a gross income tax satisfied through withholding at 30%. And interest usually qualifies for the portfolio interest exemption, but residuals in these deals suffer some problems. The other tax, which we'll get to in a little bit, is the U.S. trader business tax. When you're looking at the residuals on these old deals, what a tax lawyer sees is that you're buying the underlying assets subject to the debt that the deal issued, and so you have to look at those underlying assets to see whether or not they have an exemption. And while we've done some work to retrofit deals to make certain that they qualify for the portfolio interest exemption, a lot of deals that were done where you're talking about residuals in the 2005, 2006, 2007, 2000, even 2008 or 2009 were done with the idea that that residual would always be owned by the originator, and they never had to worry about doing anything to transfer it to a foreign fund. And now when they go to transfer the residual, they say, well, we want to sell it to the broadest market possible. That's hedge funds or that's private equity funds. Suddenly you start talking about a 30% withholding on the portion that would be paid to the foreign investors, and that makes it an unpalatable trade. And so you're trying to get to make certain that the underlying assets qualify for the portfolio interest and that they don't become subject to the withholding tax.
Yeah, and there's some challenges with that in old deals, because in order to do that, you've got to form a grantor trust in the old deal, and that's going to restrict some things, particularly with student loan securitization, some actions of the servicer that it would normally do in its ordinary course. It cannot do and still retain grantor trust status. So,
And another problem you point out to people and drives them a little crazy is the original deal may have been done with a 10% call, and now when you're doing the new deal, that call's got to be modified to make it comply with the grantor trust rules. It's got to be reduced to 10% of the current balance, and that can pose a challenge at times.
Yep. Another thing we're seeing from our hedge fund clients, Jim, is in essence, funds with foreign investors trying to get into the business of originating loans, or coming certainly very close to originating loans. And what are the strategies? We don't like to say that in tax land, but
it's not fair is that everyone wants to originate loans. I understand, banks don't want to originate loans anymore. Somebody's got to do it. Why not hedge funds?
Right.
But actually, the hedge fund doesn't want to originate loans directly. A lot of the strategy we see involve forming some sort of subsidiary to do the origination, and the concern always is that the hedge fund doesn't want to be engaging in a U.S. trader business, engaging in a lending business, either directly or through agents. And it's that through agents part that usually is going to make you pull your hair out when you're talking to a tax lawyer, because they say, if this person needs you to do the origination that they're doing and you buy their loans shortly after they're originated and you're the only person that buys their loans, then maybe they're your agent and they're worried that you have to get some separation. And that's always what you're looking at, is some separation between the origination process, the lending process, the origination activities, and the investing activities. Because it's very clear that it's fine for hedge funds, private equity funds, to do the investing in these loans, to invest in these loans. It's not good for them to actually do the lending, and so you're looking for some other entity to do the lending, and an entity that doesn't flow those activities through to the private equity fund or the hedge fund.
But we have seen some strategies there, Jim, right, where our hedge fund friends have formed these Irish 110 companies and others.
We've seen a variety of strategies. Is, you'll form a company, and there can certainly be a number of challenges in Ireland into making those deals work. You have treaty, because ultimately the question is, does the Irish company qualify for treaty benefits? And to qualify for treaty benefits, you've got to deal with that it has the correct ownership structure, directly or indirectly, and then that its expenses, so-called base erosion, isn't violated, so that the expenses that it deducts and pays to non-US folks or non-Irish folks don't exceed 50% of its gross income. We've also seen people use U.S. corporations, takes the tax drag, often referred to as a season and sell, where you have a U.S. corporation that holds the loans, originates the loans, earns the origination profit, and then after an appropriate period of time sells the loans at fair market value to their parent. And the belief is that the tension there is largely going to be one of getting the pricing correct, and if the IRS comes in and attacks it, they'll attack it on an unfair pricing, rather than saying that the U.S. corporation was acting as the agent of the hedge fund or private equity fund.
Jim, on that, it doesn't matter what asset you're talking about originating. It's all pretty much the same concept.
Whether you're talking about mortgage loans, auto loans. A lot of times we're talking mortgage loans, either residential mortgage loans or commercial mortgage loans. You'll be doing here. You'll be doing a lot of stuff here in the U.S. Usually it's not the auto loans. It's not the bank loans. Bank loans are a little different in that, hedge funds, private equity funds have for a long time invested in bank loans very shortly after origination because they didn't view someone as acting as their agent.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.